And good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding, and he and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks again for coming in all the way up from Nacogdoches and joining us here today.
Yeah, it was a hot drive, that's for sure.
I'm sure it was. Fortunately, you probably got a little AC in there.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah. That's a nice thing to have. Thank God for Mr. Carrier.
Yes.
He came through for us. Well, Cliff is our expert tonight, and again, we invite you to call in with your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and if you have a photo or a sound of a bird that you would like us to consider for future programs, please send it to my address on the web at wbeckett, that's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. That's wbeckett at lsus.edu. And Cliff, as usual, we closed out last month's program with a conservation tip. Would you mind reminding us what that was?
Yeah, we talked about keeping mosquitoes in control on your own property, because a lot of the mosquito problems that we have are man-made, human-induced. And I'm vigilant about it on my property. I keep gutters clean. I never keep tires around. These are two of the top things that hold water, that can stagnate and thus attract breeding mosquitoes. And for those that hear one of our sister shows that's much older than Bird Calls, and I'm talking about What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden here on Red River Radio, she's talked about what the deadliest animal known to man is, and it's that mosquito. More deaths have occurred from mosquitoes than anything else. You know, we always think, oh, it's a snake or a shark or tiger kills, but no, it's mosquitoes. So we have a job to do in our own yard, and that's to make sure that those potted plants with the dish underneath isn't accumulating and holding stagnant water, and just keeping things dry, keeping it mosquito unfriendly. And so we also like to talk about the birds that are our neighbors that are mosquito eaters, things like the barn swallow that might be nesting under your front porch that you think is pesky and a nuisance, but he's a good neighbor to have. He's eating flies and other pesky insects around us. So, so we have a lot of things we can do to keep the mosquito numbers down. Because those inflated issues and mosquito problems are again, human-created. In the old days, you can see those, and they still do it in parts of the Gulf Coast where they drive along with the big fogger trucks going on. Well, if you look, there's always roadside borrow ditches, and they're full of stagnating water. So we've really altered the land enough where we've created these breeding ground meccas for mosquitoes, but at least on your own property you can reduce that and actually eliminate it.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And you can get in right away. Now, Cliff, every month we do a profile species. And what's your profile species this month?
This month we're profiling the cattle egret. And although it's mostly a silent bird, cattle egrets can get very noisy at their communal nest site with non-musical sounds, as heard here. Uh-huh. Ha ha! kind of a grunting sound.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the sound, that's the most predominant sound of the cattle egret. The cattle egret is a tall, slim, snow-white bird that is often found around livestock. It's an old wives' tale that says these birds are picking the ticks off the hide of the cattle. Instead, these birds pounce on grasshoppers, crickets, mice, and other tasty critters found in the grass that flush when scared by the large livestock ambling across the pasture. Cattle egrets are also fond of foraging behind tractors that are cutting hay because there are lots of tasty grasshoppers and other small critters injured by the mower, making them easy pickings for the hungry egret. If you've heard of a, quote, cowbird, this is not the same critter. A cowbird is a small, all-dark member of the blackbird family. A myth that continues to circulate describes cattle egrets being brought from Africa by a wealthy rancher in Argentina, and what we see today spread from that introduction. Instead, flocks of cattle egrets have been seen repeatedly by ships out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on numerous occasions. In fact, the cattle egret has crossed oceans on its own to become self-introduced on several continents, including ours. It first reached the U.S. in 1942, and it was first observed in both Louisiana and Texas in 1955. In fact, the first Texas record coincided with a nearby ornithological meeting where attendees heard about the sighting and quickly jumped into their vehicles to go see the rarity because a new state record is considered exciting and special to the birding community. Nowadays, bird watchers don't blink twice at most cattle egret sightings. Cattle egrets nest in existing multi-species heronries, which are also known as rookeries, that are also used by little blue herons, snowy egrets, and others. This means that cattle egrets don't initiate the heronry. Instead, they move in alongside the other colonial nesting waterbirds, and the cattle egret usually does so in tremendous numbers that have reached 15,000 pairs or more in some localities. Large colonies of cattle egrets began to erupt in the mid-1960s in Texas, but by the early 1970s, several heronries fizzled away, mostly because the bird's guano thinned or killed their nest site vegetation. This is often why some heronries move around from site to site. Although cattle egret numbers skyrocketed in their first few decades in the U.S., their numbers have been steadily and slowly declining in the last couple of decades in Texas. To see a photo snapped by James Childress of an adult cattle egret with its showy straw-colored breeding plumes, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff, I'm going to have you turn your headphone volume up because that's also feeding our YouTube stream right now, and I'll turn yours down over here, so we'll just counterbalance it there.
And are you hearing me okay?
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
So we have our first caller online right now, and this is Don from, it says Intersex, so I'm not sure where that is at, Texas. And Don, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi, Cliff. Let's clarify where I am. I'm in Henderson, Texas.
Henderson.
Which is in Rust County between Tyler, Longview, and parts of that area.
Great.
Right.
And I've been using the Merlin Bird ID from the Cornell Institute of Ornithology, which I find very useful in identifying birds.
Uh-huh.
And I've done about 40 in my backyard, which has been a lot of fun to do just in the last few months. And it got pretty good at doing them with a visual. But when it comes to the verbal identification, if I can't see the bird, and I notice in March it's easy to see them because there's no leaves on the way, but now it's hard to see these birds to find out what they are. So I'm looking for an idea for how to identify a bird just by the sound if you can't see it. And secondly, my second question is, I think I've seen a couple of sightings of a Mississippi kite, and I can't think of any other bird that pops up on this ID that matches other than a kind of a slender wing raptor called Mississippi kite.
Right.
It sounds like a possibility that far west of its normal range.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, let's start with the kite. There, that's certainly a possibility. I saw one in Nacogdoches a couple weeks ago. I saw one about 30 minutes ago when I walked into the studio here in Shreveport, and they're in all points in between, including Henderson. And it was a bird that probably wasn't in Henderson reliably, except in migration about two or three decades ago. So it's something that's really increased in the summertime in your area and mine in the last decade or two. But in the August, we get those southbound birds. They pour through. But what you're seeing now is probably a breeding bird. It probably has a nest somewhere in the area, and that's certainly possible, Don. Your other question about the Merlin Bird App, I agree with you. It is fantastic. We have mentioned it numerous times on this show. It's a really great bird app that is fairly new, and it keeps getting refined and keeps getting better. But you're right. When you hear a bird song and you don't see the bird, because that's what I've always touted, is if you hear something, go run after it and look at the face. Who is it? And so that's usually the easiest way to identify birdsong. But if you don't have that ability, because maybe it's, like you said, the vegetation's too thick, or it's calling from across the property line, then what you want to do is try to record it and send it to us. We can work on that if you give us some time to research it before we go on the air. And if it's a good enough recording, we'll play it live and talk about the bird. But the only other way is there is an app, and I'm blanking on the name, that's a bird song app, but the reviews I've heard and the people I've talked to that have tried it, it doesn't even seem to work about 50% of the time. And so, because it's got to be a pretty sharp recording, if there's multiple birds singing, it's got problems. So I think that the way technology is heading, I would bet Merlin in short order is going to have this part of the puzzle with it soon. I think if we just wait, I think Merlin is going to be the one that we want, that we're going to be able to stick up our cell phone and, like Shazam, which identifies music and tells you within, 5 seconds or less, what band that's playing and the name of the song and everything about it. I think we're going to get that with birds and not too far in the future, is my prediction, just seeing how things are coming right now, coming along. So anyway, keep using the Merlin app, Don. It's a great one, and watch for your Mississippi kite. Maybe you can follow them to the nest site, and it should be feeding young by now, and they might actually be out on the nest. And you can tell the juvies from the adults by the barring on the tail of the young birds is the best feature. So keep an eye on the skies, Don, and thanks for the call.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. However, we do have a fairly full bank of phones right now. So John from Shreveport, Jennifer from Leesville, please hold on the line, because we've got Leon next from Bossier City. Leon, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is the activity of a senior moment. The little guy that pecks on the tree.
Downy woodpecker?
Woodpecker on the ground.
Oh, the flicker.
A rather large, in my opinion. He was, I bet you, he was 12 or 14 inches tall.
Uh-huh.
Red-headed woodpecker. And he spent, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes on the ground, running around doing this, and jump up in a tree for a minute, back on the ground.
Yep.
And I've never seen woodpeckers on the ground before.
Yeah, I've seen probably almost all the East Texas woodpeckers, and that would include Western Louisiana, those species on the ground. I've not seen hairy or downy on the ground, but I've even seen red cockaded come about ankle high off the ground in a blueberry bush getting blueberries. But I have seen red-bellied, red-headed, and pileated all on the ground. And the classic example of a woodpecker that forages on the ground is the northern flicker. But there's a lot of good food on the ground, and they're getting nuts on the ground depending on the season. There are crickets and other insects on the ground. They could have knocked something out of the tree that they're going to retrieve that fell to the ground. So woodpeckers are not confined to the tree, although they spend probably 99.9% of the day in the tree, except for the flicker. The flicker is the exception. He spends a lot of time eating ants and other insects on the ground. And the flicker, when he flies, you see this big white rump patch and a lot of yellow under the wings and tail. But
pretty good size.
Yeah, the flicker is blue jay size, so pretty good sized. And so these
was a little bigger than that.
Yeah, well, the next biggest woodpecker would be the pileated, and he's the big one with the big flowing crest, looks like Woody Woodpecker. And I've seen them on the ground only a couple of times. One was oddly in a recently plowed field that a cousin of mine was plowing not far from Alto when I was a kid, and I was impressed. But I went over and looked after the bird flew, and there was all kinds of grubs that were being pulled up by the plow and was easy pickings for that pileated. But normally you don't see a pileated on the ground that often.
Well,
so,
this was under a pecan tree.
Okay. Well, then, you know, and if there are any pecans left over, I mean, this isn't the season for pecans. But
well,
there
was a couple of months ago.
Yeah, there could be some leftovers. And if a squirrel or a blue jay got involved and buried it, maybe the woodpecker could find one that's cached away underground. But I would bet it's down there for foraging purposes. He's not just down there because, you know, they're vulnerable. They're vulnerable to predators on the ground. There's fire ants. There's a cat that could pounce them from behind the tree. So there's something tasty there that's bringing them to the ground.
I see.
Yeah.
So it is normal for a woodpecker to be on the ground.
It's normal. You just don't see it every day unless you're looking at the flicker. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank
yeah, thanks, Leon.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have lines open now. We're going to go next to Jennifer from Leesville and John from Shreveport. Please hang on the line. Jennifer, you're up. What's your question?
Well, I have a couple of questions. We have a pair of redbirds or cardinals.
Uh-huh.
There is definitely a female and a male, and they seem to like our dog's dry dog food.
Uh-huh.
Does that happen often, or is it bad for them? Because they sure are pretty.
Yeah, I've seen mostly blue jays and great-tailed grackles come to dog food bowls. I don't know that I've seen a cardinal do that, but it doesn't really surprise me because the cardinal's certainly equipped with that strong, heavy bill to crack seeds, and it could easily crack dry dog food. And so I've not witnessed it, but it doesn't surprise me. I've witnessed, again, blue jays and great-tailed grackles do it, and red-winged blackbirds, they'll do it too. But, yeah. So I don't think it's going to hurt them at all, but,
okay.
You know, I wouldn't put out extra food for the birds either
in
the dog bowl.
Absolutely. Okay, so I have a couple sugar questions, and then I'll stop. The first question is, are there roadrunners in this part of the world? Because I promise you, I've seen a little, it looks just like a little roadrunner going in off of our little road, and I've seen it a couple of different times. If it's not a roadrunner, do we have something in Louisiana that looks like a roadrunner?
No, there are roadrunners here. They're very localized, and they're very recent additions, recent by probably 50 years or so, roughly. I think, you know, our grandparents' parents probably did not see roadrunners in this area, but as we've opened up the Piney Woods, they have moved from west to east. And so, yes, you can definitely see a roadrunner in our area. I always really stop and pause when I see one because I'll probably see, I don't know, 15 or 20 a year in the Piney Woods, but that's because I'm driving around a lot and I'm paying attention. I'm focused on birds Maybe not the traffic as much as I should be, but but let's hope DPS isn't listening to that. But anyway,
yes.
But yeah, there's there's roadrunners, yeah.
Okay, and the third question is, I am beginning to see some ginormous crows. I think they're crows. These are not the little crows of storybooks and scarecrows, you know, lighting on their shoulders. These things are big.
Yeah.
They're not as big as buzzards. Is that normal? Are crows really supposed to be that big? They're huge.
Yeah, in the listening area in Leesville, in particular, there are no other species of larger than a crow, which are the ravens. There are no ravens. So, yeah, you've got to drive about 300 something miles west of you to pick up ravens that are noticeably larger than crows. There are some fish crows in your area, not far, and they're little bitty. But other than that, if you're seeing a large corvid in your area, it's an American crow.
Well, it is huge, and we're seeing a lot. I used to see the little ones, but seriously, until I got close to it, I really thought it might be a buzzard. They're kind of dealing with roadkill too.
Are you not maybe black vulture? You know, there's two species of buzzards, what we call buzzards. There's the one with the red head is the turkey vulture, and the one with the dark gray head is a black vulture. And, you know, if you're driving along the road, it can look maybe like a big giant crow. It's just got a beady head to it, though. That's the thing. It doesn't have a feathered head. The bill's wrong, but he's big and black.
Okay, well, I'll look. Maybe he is a buzzard, but
yeah.
I really thought he was a crow. Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer.
Good afternoon.
Thank
okay,
you.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and all lines are open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. John, you are up next, so if you want to call back right now, you'll get right in. And in the meantime, you know, we get a lot of questions online, and one of them is about how human impact over the years has changed the bird or ornithological landscape in our area. You just mentioned one, bringing in the roadrunners from west as we open it up. What are some of the other, you know, drastic impacts that we have that are actually destroying our bird species?
Well, I mean, let's talk about, I guess you could call them more positive, cheery things. Just think about our overpasses, our highway overpasses, and all these little birds that make nests out of mud. We've got cliff and barn swallows, and then the cave swallow, a third species, is expanding. So those highways and actually culverts too, we've created those as good nesting sites for all those swallows I mentioned. The roadrunners have moved in. The coyote has also moved in from the west. This would have been red wolf country a century ago. It was a forest canid that is gone, and coyotes have moved in. But I mean, we could spend an hour. It's a great question, but we could spend an hour on the changes that are, to me, depressing. You know, things that used to be here that aren't any longer: Carolina parakeet, passenger pigeon, ivory-billed woodpecker, to name a few. And then, you know, things that have moved in that weren't here 50 to 100 years ago: great-tailed grackle, European starling, house sparrow. All these are recent additions. Some got here on their own. Some were brought here. But I think, you know, in this area where timber industry is the big industry, that's where I think most of the change has really happened. And where we leave those trees to grow to maturity and not cut them down in a short rotation type of forest management, I think that's where we get the biggest change, is we don't have a lot of the species that require the big, giant trees that are reaching maturity. They're cut when they're way too young for forest products. I understand people need to make a living. But you can make a lot of money by leaving your timber longer, and waiting till they're a lot older, and thus giving birds more time in the forest with those bigger trees, instead of coming every 30, 40 years and cutting them in what we call short rotation. So anyway, it's a great question. We could spend an entire hour on that topic, and I could go on and on about the changes. Some positive, but many, many of them, in my opinion, negative.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Lorraine from Wynn Parish, please hang on the line. Tim from Leesville is next. Tim, what's your question tonight?
We have lived in this house for at least 17 years, and when we moved in, it had a fireplace. But we've never used it because the chimney is full of burrs, and I'm assuming they're chimney sweeps. I think that's the name of them.
It's chimney swift.
Swift?
Yes. So
okay.
The chimney sweep is usually the guy that comes and cleans the chimney.
Okay. As a top hat.
Yeah, and so that's definitely a dead breed of employment. There are very, very few chimney sweeps left, but the chimney swift is the bird that thinks of your chimney like an old hollow tree, and that's historically what those birds used, is a dead tree that's hollow that broke off at maybe 18 or 30 foot up, and it looks like a chimney. And so that's a bird you can live harmoniously with, because that's a bird that's not with us in the colder months. They get out of here and winter down in Peru and other parts of South America. So in the warmer months, we don't need the fireplace, so you can close your damper and let them have it. And they'll build a nest inside with saliva and sticks. They use the saliva as like sticky glue to adhere to the brick, and they'll raise their young. And they're good neighbors to have. They're eating a lot of these pesky insects that we have in our yards, and they're keeping their airways clean. So that's the chimney swift.
Well, I'm wondering how big of a mess I have in there since they've been there for 15 years and I don't use that fireplace. Is it totally clogged up with, you know, their homes? Nest?
Probably not. I mean, they don't nest in these big colonies, so it's probably been one nest a year. That nest probably falls down before the next breeding season. So there might be a couple of piles of, you know, sticks that have rotted and the saliva's dried up, and it would be like maybe wadded up the size of a golf ball and not very big. And if you've had 10 years of it and they've nested every year, I bet that nest from 10 years ago is probably vaporized and there's probably not much left. But the only way to tell is to get up under there, or, you know, open the damper. Don't put your head under it. Open the damper and use a mirror, or, you know, use your cell phone and use the camera function where you can, you know, look at the screen. You know, what is that called? Where you, the self picture?
Yeah,
the reverse. I've done that before. To get in the back of my refrigerator, I needed to see what was back there, and I used that function on my phone. It worked great. So you could do the same. But you know, I wouldn't look at it as that it would be like a big mess up there of stuff that is going to make you sick and die. It's not going to be like that. But it's something that you'd probably want to clean after 10 years. But to me, it'd be worth it if these guys are, as our neighbors, are doing their service for free, and that's keeping our airways a little cleaner of insects, then that to me is worth it. So, Tim, I think you got a little homework, because I don't think there's going to be many chimney sweeps you're going to find in the phone book, but I might be wrong. But if you do find one, call him or her up and get them on it. Mm-hmm. They are definitely going to be the ones that are going to get the, you know, caked on soot on the sides of your chimneys and clean that up too, because that was their big job, was cleaning the inches of soot buildup, because that would catch fire and would sometimes burn the whole house down. So in the good old days when, you know, 100% of your heat and cooking was in the fireplace, that was a big deal. That was a big issue. But since air conditioning and central heat and air, and even gas heaters, we don't use the chimneys like we do, and we certainly don't cook. I don't know anybody that cooks from the chimney anymore, like you see on Harry Potter movies and on the big screen. But I guess that would be kind of fun, go to mm-hmm. someone's house that has a pot churning and it looks like a, you know, somebody's cooking some gruel or something. But anyway, I hope that answers your question, Tim.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can get in now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I know for my apartment complex, they hire a chimney sweep company to come around, you know, as a safety factor. And whether you use the fireplace or not, they give it a good scrub down. So there's somebody out there still doing
good,
it.
Good. That's great.
It's an interesting occupation. Yeah. And we're going to go next. We've got a couple of callers online. Michael, please stay on the line. And also Bob from Natchitoches, please stay on the line. Lorraine from Wind Parish is next. Lorraine, what's your question tonight?
My question is about house finches. We have had a fairly reliable colony of house finches for the last 15 or so years, and this year we have had practically nothing. And I'm just wondering if the problem we had last fall is a result, you know, is resulting from that. Because there for a while in October, November, the birds seemed to be having trouble getting off the ground, and our dog thought they were toys, and she must have killed five or six. But this spring, we have had maybe three house finches out of the 15 or 20 that we have been having. Have they had some kind of a virus or something going along around them?
I mean, house finches have the house, what's called the house finch disease. People see them at their feeders often with these growths crusting over their eyes, and it seems to be just predominantly house finches, but no, I've not heard of any big crash in house finch population in our area. But I can say that, you know, that's a bird in my area and probably at your same latitude we didn't have till the late 80s, early 90s. And what typically happens with birds that colonize, you'll see just a skyrocket. You know, the numbers jump up and they just explode, but that doesn't last forever. And there seems to be a leveling out, and I think we've seen that with house finches. And then sometimes you'll see a lot of these critters, the same critter we're talking about, it'll just crash. And the species I profiled, the cattle egret, is a great example. I mentioned that during that profile earlier that until 1955 we didn't have any in Louisiana and Texas, and then by the mid 60s they were skyrocketing, and if you look now their numbers are slowly and steadily declining. That doesn't mean they're going to zero. It just means that skyrocketing trend, like a I don't know, like a skyrocketing trend of a sky on the stock market that just crashes, is normal. And so I think maybe we might be seeing that with house finch, although I don't have any data to support that. So I don't know, Lorraine, if house finch numbers are hurting or not.
Well, I miss them because they are they go in such groups, you see, and they sit around and they chat and they gossip and they eat.
Right.
And I miss them when they're not here.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if we've seen house finches much lately in our yard. I definitely listen for that one, and I hear them all over town. But again, in my town, we didn't have them until about 1989, if I recall correctly. So it was definitely not there in 1985, and I bet you in Wind Parish as well. So. It's a recent arrival. I think it is a great bird. They are fun to watch, but I don't know what's going on with your birds in particular, Lorraine. I'm sorry.
Well, I hope they show up.
Yeah.
I hope they aren't gone totally because they are really nice little birds.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Lorraine.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. And we're going to go next to Bob from Natchitoches. Bob, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yeah, hey, Cliff.
Hey, Bob. Hello.
I got birds out in the woods. I live out in the woods, and there's one in particular that I only hear at night. Never seen them, but they kind of whistle. Like they sound something like this.
Huh.
And then they'll go.
Well,
and it's very loud, but I've never seen it. I just wonder what that could be.
Well, Bill's pulled up the Chuck Wills Widow. That's let's start with that one. Is that your bird there?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. And if it's called the Chuck Wills Widow, a lot of people incorrectly call them whippoorwills.
That's what I thought it might have been, a whippoorwill.
Yeah, yeah, and so we have whippoorwills that only migrate through East Texas and western Louisiana in a short window, and here's the whippoorwill playing.
Now, it's the first one again.
Yeah, no one's hearing this bird we're playing in the hot summer months of June and July. Or even May. So that bird is a Chuck Wills Widow. Let's do it one more time, Bill.
All
and
right.
That's probably your bird, Bob.
And it's a
Chuck Wills Widow. And that's a onomatopoeic. It's a name that is transcribed from what they sound like. Another one is Bob White. Sounds like he's saying Bob White. Kill deer. So Chuck Wills Widow. Sounds like he's saying Chuck Wills Widow.
Night.
I'm sorry?
I only hear him at night.
Yeah, he's a nocturnal bird. He sleeps in the day.
I never see it. Is it big, small?
He's pretty large. He's not as big as a crow. He's not as big as a pileated woodpecker, but he's bigger than a blue jay. And you won't see him. He's going to be hard to see. The only time I ever see him is drive around country roads, and they'll fly up off the road. They've got orangish colored eyes in the headlights.
Oh, how about that?
But
they eat tomatoes?
They eat insects. They're real big moth eaters.
All right, well, so, the crows are getting my tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, no, the Chuck Wills Widow isn't the one. It's yeah, and there's, oh, man, everybody wants to eat tomatoes.
A motion detector out there now that's scaring them off. So.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, great. Well,
hey, thanks a lot.
Okay,
Cliff.
Bob. Thank you.
Bye.
You bet. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Ken from North Caddo, please hang on the line because we've got Michael right before you. Michael, what's your question tonight? Okay, well, we don't have Michael, so hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, this is Ken. I can hear you.
Oh, okay, Tim. Tim, what's your question tonight?
Ken.
Oh, Ken.
Okay, Ken.
Okay, I'm now going over Cross Lake, but I was on I-49 just south of things at 231. I think it's 12 Mile Bayou. Anyway, it's a bayou, and I saw five or six tall, elegant wading birds. What do you think they are?
What color?
White. Completely white.
Probably great egrets.
Okay.
Great egrets like the water's edge, so they're a big cousin of the cattle egret that we talked about earlier that are out in the fields near the livestock. So the great egret is double the size, and they're usually getting their feet wet.
Yeah, they were in the water. One had a fish. One spiked down with that long beak and came up with a little 2 or 3 inch some kind of fish.
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay. That's good.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ken.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. And we have lines open right now. And now we are going to go to Lorraine. Lorraine, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
No, we had Lorraine. Is this Lorraine again from Wind Parish?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. This is Michael.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
We'll get it right.
I'm calling from the monastery. I have quite a bit of property, and one spring, sir, there was a huge, I would say 300 little birds. They were iridescent blue. Their migration, I don't know what they were. They flew into the whole back of the monastery. It was crazy.
The indigo bunting?
It could, perhaps.
Yes.
I couldn't believe the color.
Yes, they are. They're exactly what you described. And I've seen big groups, especially the closer you get to the coast.
Uh-huh.
I've seen fields or mowed areas where there's a weather event, and there'll be, like you said, 300 of them on the ground, and they're bright blue, the males are.
They're fabulous.
I have
never seen anything. The second one, very briefly, about 2 weeks ago, my trees have fruit and berries. The whole tree was stripped with everything.
That's neat. Yeah. So where's your monastery, Michael?
It's in Natchitoches.
Okay, uh-huh. That's cool. Well, yeah. that's neat that you saw that, because that is not something you see every day. I mean, you can see one or two indigo bunnings, but if you saw 300 that got grounded in migration, that was a treat.
Well,
so,
I'm telling you, sir, I've never... I'll be very briefly. The other question I have for you... I remember, and I'm from the West Coast.
Okay.
And they had farms, and they had these guinea hens.
Uh-huh.
Are those oriental species? Did they bring them in from the Asia, the guinea hens?
Yeah, I think guineas are African, but they're certainly not native. So
I wondered,
yeah.
What do people eat them?
No, they keep them for like a barking dog, because guinea hens don't like something out of place, and a different truck or someone walking down the driveway, they will start hollering, then that alerts the homeowner to just like with a barking dog of what's going on.
I stayed in the house. I was afraid as a child. I saw these things walking around here.
Yes. So the guinea hen is a caged bird. It's not native, and...
Uh-huh.
And you know, they make good pets, but unfortunately, every predator wants to eat a guinea hen. So you've got bobcats, foxes, two species of foxes. You've got neighbor dogs, neighbor house cats, red-tailed hawks, great horned owls, coyotes. I could go on and on. Everybody wants to eat any kind of gallinaceous bird that you're going to have running free, and that includes guinea hens and chickens. So if you love your cage birds, keep them in a cage because they're safer that way.
Well, they're so exotic.
Yes. And did you remember guinea hens getting all riled up and hollering? I mean, it's super loud when there's just three or four individuals. They just
like a peacock or something.
It's just crazy. And so that is they don't do it just any time. There's something that's upsetting them. It might be a hawk that landed over there on the fence post across the way, but they'll let you know if there's something different that shouldn't be there, and that's why people keep guineas.
I see. I just saw that. I lived in the country, and I just saw them in the farm. And then I was afraid of them.
Oh, yeah.
As a child.
Oh, yeah. And as a kid, sure, but they're pretty harmless. And they make good pets.
Well, I appreciate your information.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Have a good time.
You too.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a question right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. And in the meantime, we had the whippoorwill, which is something that, you know, it sounds at night, which is unusual for most birds. So what are some of the other things that we might hear at night,
right,
but aren't birds, and yet they sound like birds?
And I get a lot of calls about, there's a little bird outside my window calling all night long. What is it? And it's not a bird. And let's listen to it right here. A little chirp, chirp. And they'll just go on all night. So it's not very rhythmic. There'll be some pauses, and it's a chirping sound, and the name is Rio Grande Chirping Frog. So this is a frog, not a bird, and you'll realize it if you start going outside thinking, oh, I've got to see this bird. Nothing flies away. It's at night. And actually, if you start shine the light, the frog gets quiet. And he's very small. He's the size of your pinky nail. So he's really small. And he can hide behind the stem of any plant that he's calling from. So if you hear that chirping at night, it's not a bird. And it's a fairly recent addition to our listening area. That one is moved in probably by potted plants that we bring in big truckloads and sell them at stores, and then we take them home, and you didn't know that there was a chirping frog in it. So chirping frogs are all over our listening area now, and they weren't a couple decades ago.
Are there any other frogs that we might mistake at night?
Yeah, the gray tree frog, and we have that one. We've covered all these. It's always good to discuss this stuff. And these are gray tree frogs that are very bird-like. So, yeah, if you look in the tree for a bird, you're never going to see one. Or maybe by coincidence something will fly out, but those are frogs up in the trees, not birds.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now. You'll get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Leon is calling back from Bossier. Leon, you're back on with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is about the guineas.
Okay.
Speaking of earlier.
Yep.
Have you ever tried to eat a guinea egg?
No, I never have. Have you?
Yes.
And is it taste good or bad? I'm guessing bad.
No, it's okay.
Okay, not too strong.
And they're really hard. It's almost like a golf ball.
Huh.
We used to throw them at each other when we were my two sisters.
And were they hard enough that they didn't explode, or did they always explode?
No, they were tough. They're kind of small and they're tough, but anyway, it just brought back memories.
Okay.
And the guinea eggs, you got to have, I guess they're probably a third of the size of a small chicken egg.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've never had one, but that won't stop me. I'm going to try it sometime if I can find somebody that's got some guinea eggs to share. So, that's cool.
You'd be surprised at how hard they are.
Okay.
How difficult they are to break.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Okay, well, thanks for that information, Leon. Appreciate it.
Sort of like little dinosaur shells almost.
Yeah, little. Anyway, cool.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can get in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and we have Diana on the road between Henderson and Marshall right now. Diana, what's your question?
Okay, Cliff, I know this is a hard one because you don't have a picture and I don't have one to send you.
Okay.
I'm curious about a bird that I've been seeing flying out of the brushy areas of my yard, and it's the color of a dying pine tree. It's that rusty brown color, and it's slightly larger than maybe a blue jay.
Okay.
And I have no idea what it is.
Okay. I bet you it's a brown thrasher. And you've described it very well. And so since we don't have a picture, I think when you hang up and have a chance to look online, go look up brown thrasher. And we're playing the sound of it because we've profiled that bird in the distant past. That's one of the calls of the brown thrasher that Bill's playing right now. And they really like hiding in the shrubs, like you mentioned. The way I see my backyard one the best is because of our bird bath, and probably daily or every other day. I don't know what his schedule is. I'm not staring at my bird bath all the time, but he comes in enough that I get a really good look at him when he's at the bird bath. So maybe that's, if you want to get a good look, maybe invest in a bird bath, and maybe your brown thrasher will not have that stage fright that they usually have. But that's what I'm guessing your bird is, Diana.
Okay, well, I can't wait to look it up when I get
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All Love your program.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. While we're waiting for the next call to come through, these are some examples. You had mentioned some of the birds, like the finches moving in. These are some examples of how humans change the landscape, I would presume, so
yeah.
That the finches were not here at a previous time.
Yeah, the house finch is an interesting story because it's more of a western, kind of a desert southwest bird that maxed out in West Texas, but someone took several and shipped them up to New York, up in the Northeast somewhere, and released them. And from those eastern released birds, they spread like wildfire and eventually reached the normal range of the house finch in West Texas. So, and we know where the range was because, for example, Howard Lacey in the 1800s, early 1900s, wrote about house finches not being on his property in Kerrville, Texas. So that's in the hill country. So I think it was probably just to the Chihuahuan Desert. And so that would be maybe as far east as Sonora, Ozona, if you look at a map of Texas, West Texas, probably out to there. And so these birds that, like Lorraine was talking about earlier, those are all progeny of these release birds out in the east 100 years ago. Yeah.
All right. And we've got callers on the line. We're going to go next to Jim from Shreveport and Pamela from Alexandria. Please hang on the line. Eric from Pollock is up next. Eric, what's your question?
Oh, yeah. I live over there, of course, I said Pollock, which is Central Louisiana. I got these red-headed woodpeckers that used to be kind of rare, it seems, but now I'm seeing a whole lot of them this year. I was just wondering if maybe there was something climate-wise in that area that you know of that maybe has caused there to be increase, or it's just a cool phenomenon.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things going on with red-headed woodpecker. I think the biggest thing is they're pretty showy, so they're easily detectable. They're noisy when they fly by. I mean, that is the most starched white, crisp feathering you've ever seen.
Right.
But in the last 40 years, that bird has declined considerably. So I don't know if we're seeing some benefit, but they do pretty well in urban settings because our trees have matured and they don't like dense forests in the breeding season. They kind of like it more open, like what you'd have in a lawn setting. So they do well in urban settings. They're good. They do good on golf courses, older neighborhoods, and so forth. Out in the country, similar setting. If you've got big woods where it's fairly open, and the wintertime they switch to typically dense bottomland hardwood forests full of acorn-giving water oaks, willow oaks, and the like. So they do a little bit of habitat switching, but I don't know if I've seen an increase. I just know that when there's a red-headed woodpecker around, I'm going to either see it or hear it because they're super noisy. And that white is just super contrasting on the black, the rest of the bird that's black and red. So I think they're just really detectable. They're on telephone posts, poles. They're on dead limbs. They're really showy and easy to see. Versus the last caller, Diana talked about, I think, one of the biggest skulkers of them all, the brown thrasher. And it's a large bird that has tremendous stage fright most of the time. They'll sometimes run out and mowed lawn, but boy, they're quick to run back in the shrub as if, you know, someone's going to spot them. But a red-headed woodpecker is showy. He's out there in the sunny spot of that telephone pole and showing off. So I just think that they're just a very detectable bird.
Fair enough, then,
yeah.
Man. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Eric.
All right, and we've got two callers online, so we're going to get to those as quickly as possible. Jim from Shreveport, you're up next. What's your question?
Yeah, a bird I used to hear a lot at night was nighthawks. I don't hear too many of those anymore.
Yeah, there is a definite decline in nighthawks and a lot of the aerial insectivores. It's a variety of things. It's a lot of it could be chemicals we're spraying. You know, insects are definitely frowned upon. We spray. We try to get rid of them in agricultural settings. And inadvertently, there's a lot of critters that are relying on those. And the common nighthawk is one of those. And there's definitely been a dramatic decline in common nighthawks. So it doesn't surprise me that you're not seeing them. I don't like it that they're declining. But I don't broadcast sprays, but I'm not, you know, I'm not your typical consumer. And then I don't have an agricultural facility that I'm screaming at productivity going down because you got these insect plagues. So I it's very frustrating. It's a bad circle, and the common nighthawk is the loser in that circle.
All right. Thank you for your call, Jim. And very quickly, we've got to get to Pamela on from Alexandria. Pamela, please state your question very quickly as we're running out of time.
I'm a missionary in Africa, and we have a lot of guinea fowls. I'm curious. I mean, I know why the Africans keep them, and I've seen them in the wild, but why in the world would they import them to the United States?
Well, like I mentioned, they make good watchdogs, and so they're just another exotic cage bird that you have to your repertoire out there on the farm. You've got cows, horses, sheep, goats, chickens, dogs, cats, and sometimes guineas. And the role they serve, again, is a watchdog. They are very vociferous, very vocal when something unusual is going on, like someone coming up the driveway. So that's probably the number one reason why people have guineas is for that watchdog aspect.
I just know over there they keep them to raise, like people do chickens here.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they're out in the Pirini, out in the Serengeti, places like that, by the droves.
Yeah, and it's more of an arid land bird, so it can handle that, whereas our chickens came from Southeast Asia, and they were a forest bird, and they did better in a wet climate that was shaded. So that they wouldn't do well in Africa.
All right, and that wraps it up for this edition. Cliff, as usual, you give us a conservation tip at the end of every show, and what do you have for this month?
This month we're going to talk about saving green space. Did you ever catch yourself in calm reflection while staring at your backyard trees, flowers, or other greenery? How about the same while staring at the side of a neighbor's house or building? Nope, it's not the same. Humans benefit from open green space, and as our cities grow, we need more of it whether we know it or not. Parks and open space are economic engines that can boost adjacent home prices anywhere from 8 to 20%, according to one study. Residences next to a larger and longer green belt area, which is great for birding, hiking, and biking, saw a 32% increase in home value on average, according to another study. Many people are willing to pay more to be near or next to open space as, most importantly, it boosts quality of life by giving more space for exercise, peace, solitude, and a place for reflection and relaxation. You'll feel better with more green space in your daily life, plus it'll give our birds more area to inhabit. Work with your city planners, urban developers, and government officials to increase parkland in your community. Do it not only for yourself, but do it for the birds.
All right. Thank you again, Cliff, for coming up and being our resident expert.
Great. Thanks.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist at Red River Radio and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to thank everybody at Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Our producers for this program were Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from Julie Shackelford, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Schnell tonight, as well as Wally Derleth. The sound files for tonight's profiled species were from xenocanto.org and recorded by Paul Marvin, and this month's bird photos were snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be up in a few hours at redriverradio.org, and remember to join us next time for the next installment of Bird Calls on August 13th, and next week will be What's Bugging You. This is Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore.